Though the digital clock on the bedside table in his hotel room read 5:17, Jack Griffin, suddenly wide awake, knew he wouldn't be able to get back to sleep. He'd allowed himself to drift off too early the night before. On the heels of wakefulness came an unpleasant realization that what he hadn't wanted to admit yesterday, even to himself, was now all too clear in the solitary pre-dawn dark. He should have swallowed his petulance and waited the extra day for joy. It had been their long-established habit to flee the campus as soon as Griffin taught his last class. Usually, they hopped on the Freedom Trail, his term for I-95, drove to New York and treated themselves by checking into a good hotel. During the day, he would evaluate his small mountain of student portfolios while Joy shopped or otherwise amused herself. And then, evenings, they'd catch up on movies and go to restaurants. The whole thing reminded him of the early years of their marriage back in L.A. It cost a small fortune, but there was something about spending money they didn't really have that made him optimistic about more coming in, which was how it had worked in L.A., and it got him through the portfolios. This year, Kelsey's Cape Cod wedding had royally screwed up their plans, making New York impractical, though he'd been willing to substitute Boston. But Joy, assuming that, thanks to the wedding, all the usual bets were off, had messed things up further by scheduling meetings on the day after his last class. "Just go," she said when he expressed his annoyance at the way things were working out. "Have a boys' night out in Boston, and I'll meet you on the Cape." He'd squinted at this proposal. Didn't you need more than one to have a boys' night out? Or had Joy meant it to be singular? One boy celebrating his boyness. Was that how she'd understood the phrase all her life, as singular? Joy's relationship to the English language was not without glitches. She was forever mixing metaphors, claiming that something was a tough line to hoe. Row to hoe? Line to walk? Her sisters, Jane and June, were even worse, and when corrected, all three would narrow their eyes dangerously and identically. If they'd had a family motto, it would have been, "You know perfectly well what I mean." In any event, his wife's suggestion that he go on without her had seemed less than sincere, which was why he decided to call her bluff. "All right," he said, "that's what I'll do," expecting her to say, "Fine, if it means that much to you, I'll reschedule the meetings." But she hadn't said that, even when she saw him packing his bag, and so he'd discovered a truth that other men probably knew already. That once you'd packed a bag in front of a woman, there was no possibility of unpacking or of not going and taking the damn bag with you. Worse, Joy, who preferred to watch movies on DVD rather than in a theater as they were meant to be seen, had given him a list of films he was forbidden to see without her. And of course, these were the only ones worth seeing. He'd spent an hour looking through the restaurant guides provided by the hotel, but couldn't decide on one, or even on what kind of food he wanted. Griffin had no trouble making these sorts of decisions when she was around, but for some reason, when he had only himself to please, he often couldn't make up his mind. He told himself this was just the result of being married for 34 years. That part of the decision-making process was imagining what his wife would enjoy. Okay, but more and more he found himself stalled, in the middle of whatever room he happened to be standing in, and he realized that this had been, of course, his father's classic pose. In the end, Griffin had ordered room service and watched a crappy made-for-TV movie, the kind he and Tommy, his old partner, had been reduced to writing that last year or two in L.A. before he'd gotten his teaching gig and moved back east with Joy and their daughter, Laura. He'd fallen asleep before the first commercial, confident he could predict not only the movie's outcome, but also half its dialogue. In order not to dwell on yesterday's mistakes, he decided to put today in motion by calling down to the bell captain for his car. 20 minutes later, dressed and showered, he'd checked out of his Back Bay hotel. The whole of Boston fit neatly into the rectangle of his rearview mirror, and by the time the Sagamore Bridge, one of two that spanned the Cape Cod Canal, hove into view, the sky was silver in the east, and he felt the last remnants of yesterday's prevarications begin to lift like the patchy fog he'd been in and out of since leaving the city. The Sagamore arched dramatically upward in the middle, helping to pull the sun over the horizon, and though the air was far too cool, Griffin pulled off onto the shoulder of the road and put the convertible's top down, feeling truly off the reservation for the first time since leaving home in Connecticut. There was something vaguely thrilling about not being where his wife thought he was. She liked to know what people were up to, and not just him. She called Laura most mornings, her brain still lazy with sleep, to ask, "So, what's on the agenda for you today?" She also phoned both of her sisters several times a week and knew that June was having her hair done tomorrow morning and that Jane had put on 5 pounds and was starting a diet. She even knew what new folly her idiot twin brothers, Jared and Jason, were engaged in. To Griffin, an only child, such behavior was well over the line that separated the merely inexplicable from the truly perverse.